Bill Lester joins us on Sports Byline. Bill is only one of seven black drivers to race in NASCAR's top-tier Cup Series and was the first African-American to win a Rolex Sports Car Series race. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of California, and fresh out of college, he worked at the Hewlett-Packard Company for 15 years before deciding to focus full-time on auto racing. Bill, first of all, where did the desire for auto racing come from?
Well, it started really very early on. I was told by my folks that I didn't go anywhere without a Matchbox or a Hot Wheels in my hand. So I definitely love cars, and I was the kind of kid that I couldn't get enough of roller coasters and anything that went fast. So I knew I had an obsession with speed. So that's kind of the marriage of those two desires, those two loves. And it was really my father who took me to a race just shy of 8 years old that set the hook up in Monterey at Laguna Seca with a Can-Am race back in 68 or 69. And I just was just blown away. I was mesmerized by the whole experience and didn't realize that that could be something that I could aspire to, because I didn't see really anybody else that looked like me at the racetrack. But I definitely had that in the back of my mind that that would be really cool to be a race car driver.
Tell me, when you were eight years old, what your impressions were of auto racing at that time.
God, I mean, it would just seem like the most exciting thing in the world to do. I mean, I just couldn't believe how fast these cars were going and how loud they were, and just, you know, the smell of the oil and the fuel and the brakes. And, I mean, all those just visceral images and senses just being on overload. It was just amazing. And I was like, man, it would just be so cool to be a race car driver. I mean, instead of pushing cars around like I was doing at that age, I figured, boy, it would be sure a lot of fun to actually drive them when I get older.
You came to NASCAR after working in tech in California. As I mentioned, you came out of the University of California with a degree. And you said something I was interested in. You said you were an oddball in the sport. What did you mean by that?
In the sport of auto racing, you're asking?
Yes, yes.
Well, I mean, just an anomaly. You know, I mean, there just weren't many of color that were out there racing cars. I remember when I went through my first CCA, or Sports Car Club of America, driving school, that I didn't see anybody else that looked like me. And, you know, I mean, it was very surreal just how much of an island I was on. You know, even early on when I started amateur racing, I didn't see anybody else running around that was black, or, you know, just hardly anybody other than white. And I was an oddball in that respect. It was just a situation where, you know, a lot of people of color were, you know, blacks in particular, in the stick and ball sports very heavily. But, I mean, we just really made no real inroads in motorsports. So I definitely felt like, you know, I was off there to the side.
You said you had to do your best to understand your teammates. What type of understanding were you looking for yourself with them and you with them?
So now you're kind of moving forward to when I started out in NASCAR.
Right.
That's kind of when I started making that statement. And what I meant by that is, when I committed to racing in NASCAR, I was living in Northern California at the time, in the Bay Area, specifically in Oakland. And you cannot race NASCAR from the Bay Area. You have to basically, you know, bring yourself to the Southeast and just, you know, bring yourself into their culture, into that culture of NASCAR, into where the race teams are based and housed, and where everybody who's in the sport is based. And so my wife and I made the commitment to come to the Southeast. We chose Atlanta because we wanted to be in the greatest metropolitan city that we could find that was in proximity to either North Carolina or Tennessee, which is because when I was starting out in the truck series, Bobby Hamilton was based in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. So he was one of the few racing teams that wasn't there in North Carolina. But I figured, my wife and I figured, if we were in Atlanta, we were close enough that I could get to either North Carolina or to Tennessee in a reasonable amount of time. So that's why we wound up coming to the Southeast. That's why we chose Atlanta. You know, it's just one of those situations where you can't just show up and race. You have to become part of the culture. And so that's what I spent a lot of my time doing, trying to understand my teammates, trying to understand the guys that were working on these cars and trucks and putting them together. And being part of that team, I just didn't want to be somebody who was a quote-unquote driver. I wanted to see where these guys are coming from. We would go to lunch and such and go to places like Cracker Barrel, which I'd never even heard of when I was in California. I was like, what is a Cracker Barrel? And they're like, what's going to be like, what do you mean with a crack? You don't know what a Cracker Barrel is? Or what's Crystal Hamburger? I'm like, I don't know what a Crystal Hamburger is. And they're like, yeah, we're going to go to get some crystals. I'm like, so anyway, I saw what these fully breaded and lack of meat sandwiches were. And I was like, I don't understand what the attraction is, but they'd like to eat about a dozen of them and call it good. But anyway, their idea of enjoying a lunch was a little bit different than mine. But I just wanted them to understand that I was just a regular guy, even though they didn't know who I was. I basically showed up out of nowhere. You know, they did not know who Bill Lester was. I really had no big name for myself. I hadn't really done anything super substantial. You know, I'd done some stuff in sports car road racing, but the NASCAR community could care less about sports car road racing. So it was almost like one of those situations where Tom Cruise in Days of Thunder shows up on his motorcycle to come and test a stock car. And they all look at him like, who is this guy? You know, he was out there racing Indy cars. We don't know who he is. Can he even drive? You know, that sort of thing. Well, it's kind of like the same thing with me, because I didn't grow up in the Southeast. I didn't grow up on, you know, dirt, which is what most of the NASCAR drivers say they all have in common. Well, I didn't have that in common. I've never been on a dirt track. Even to this very day, I've never even seen a dirt track personally. I've seen it on television, but I've never actually been to a dirt track. And I didn't grow up through the ranks that most of those NASCAR drivers did, which is, you know, Bandoleros and Legends and Quarter Midgets and, you know, the stepping stones that they take to get to NASCAR. I grew up road racing a sports car. So needless to say, they didn't know who I was. I came out of nowhere. They're like, okay, so who is this guy? And so I just spent a lot of time trying to understand where they were coming from and them understanding where I was coming from. And what I mean by that is when I first came over from the tech industry, you know, in that culture, white-collar environment to a very blue-collar environment, I was talking in a language that they just did not really appreciate. You know, I was using multisyllabic words and describing things that they were having a hard time comprehending. I remember my first test with one of my teams, and they asked me how the truck was, and I said, it's diabolical. And I heard nothing but silence on the other end of the radio. They never even responded. And they said, Bill, can you bring it into the pit? I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm coming in this time. I come in the pit, they drop the window net, and they say, diabolical? What is that? And I'm like, you know, it's just what I meant. The truck isn't doing what I'm asking it to do. And they said, listen, either it's loose or it's tight. They're like, keep it simple. I'm like, okay. Because even up to that point, I was using from road racing terms like understeer to mean tight and oversteer to mean loose. They didn't understand what understeer and oversteer was. It was like, either the truck is loose or tight, tell me what it's like on entry, tell me what it's like through the middle of the corner, tell me what it's like on exit, but use simple words like loose and tight. So yeah, what I'm trying to indicate is that it was a real baptism by fire to come into the NASCAR ranks.
Yeah, I'm smiling here because I laughed a little bit. I assumed, because of your background going to the University of California, being in tech for such a long period of time, you were approaching the experience from an intellectual basis, and that was not the way they would understand it. And I suppose that was something that was a challenge to you in your early days.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. I mean, I come from an analytical way of thinking and speaking and you know, conveying my thoughts and what have you. And these guys were like, keep it simple, make it basic. And I was like, okay. So it was a complete mind shift on my part. I'm used to, you know, defining and describing things and lots of detail and all that sort of thing. They're like, no, just take it up a notch and, you know, a level and just make it easy for us to understand. And so, believe me, I was really changing my vocabulary an awful lot, focused on doing that heavily so that, you know, I wasn't like a prima donna. They didn't consider me a prima donna or, you know, speaking down to them or anything like that. It's just the way that I was used to carrying myself. You know, after 15 years in the high tech sector, you're used to a certain environment and a certain way of conducting yourself and doing business. And this was the complete opposite.
We only have about 40 seconds before we have to break here. But, Bill, was there ever a time where you did feel comfortable? How long did that take?
Where I actually did feel comfortable?
Yeah, in other words, with the atmosphere and everything you were dealing with.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Ron. I was never completely comfortable. I always had my guard up and my suspicions because of the environment that I was surrounded in. It just never let me or allowed me to really let my guard down.
Bill Lester is with us on Sports Byline. We're talking about his life and his career. Bill is one of only seven black drivers to race in NASCAR's top-tier Cup Series and was the first African-American to win a Rolex Sports Car Series race. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on America's sports talk show, Sports Byline. Bill Lester is with us on Sports Byline USA. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree from Cal fresh out of college. He worked at Hewlett-Packard for 15 years before deciding to focus full-time on auto racing, and he is one of only seven black drivers to race in NASCAR's top-tier Cup Series. You know, you and I were talking about the experience for you, not only from a mental standpoint, but from an emotional standpoint, and how they lived their lives and how you had lived your lives. I suppose that was kind of like an out-of-body experience, wasn't it, Bill?
Yeah, it truly was. It was unbelievable just how we come from really just two different sides of the track, so to speak. And it was, you know, a matter of just trying to, you know, get an appreciation for their way of life, the way they thought, and just the things that they enjoyed doing. Like, for example, when we were away from the shop and, you know, just trying to understand what these guys like to do for fun, it was just all a matter of, you know, how soon can we start drinking beer? Here I am going, okay. Coming from Northern California, they say this land of wine and cheese as opposed to beer and pretzels. Well, it was truly the case. I mean, these guys just wanted to drink beer, talk about women, chase skirts and stuff like that. Here I am married. I have no interest in doing that. I have no interest in drinking beer and just all the things that were so different. I mean, I remember one conversation the crew and I had where they were talking about a problem with their Cub Cadet, which is a riding lawnmower, for those that don't know, like myself at the time. I did not know what a Cub Cadet was, and I made this silly mistake of saying in the middle of the conversation, what's a Cub Cadet? And the conversation all stopped. Everybody looked at me like, what do you mean you don't know what a Cub Cadet is? I'm like, listen, in Northern California, you don't have that kind of grass. You don't have that kind of acreage that you need a riding mower. If you have a push mower, you can pretty much accomplish everything you need to do with regard to cutting your grass. Maybe an electric mower, but a riding mower was completely out of the question. So I had no idea what a Cub Cadet was, and they roasted me for it.
How did you look upon the Confederate flag? Because, I mean, obviously being in the South, and it's something that's been talked a great deal about, seeing it fly over an event or just encountering it in your everyday life, how did you react to that? Because that had to be foreign to you as well, Bill.
It truly was, and it was something I really had to try to overlook when I knew I was making the commitment to race in NASCAR, because my earliest real impressions of the Confederate flag I gained when I was watching, like, ABC's Wide World of Sports when I was a youngster. I would watch the Daytona 500 and the Southern 500 and the Talladega 500, and I would watch the broadcast, and I would see all these flags, you know, just proudly flying in the breeze, and they were Confederate flags, and I was like, that's not appealing to me. And then when, you know, the broadcaster, or I would say the pit reporter, would talk to a driver out of the race or whatever the case is, and I would hear them with their Southern drawl and their heavy, you know, accent, and I would struggle to understand what they were saying. And I was like, man, this is, I mean, unusual. It's so different than what I'm used to in terms of, you know, how people speak. And, you know, it was just a matter of realizing that when I came to the South, I'm the oddball again. I'm the one that has to try to adjust and accommodate what is regular culture in the South. And, you know, when I came to the South initially and first heard all the ways that people greet each other as ma'am and sir and, you know, that sort of thing with regard to the whole Bible culture and stuff, I just, in Northern California, you know, it's Mr. or Mrs. or what have you if you're formal, but not, you know, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, and stuff like that. That was just, to me, completely foreign and odd. And, you know, I've been here in the South now for about 20 years, and you can tell I still don't say, you know, ma'am and sir, and I don't really speak with any sort of Southern accent. So, you know, I keep it real, but, you know, it's still a situation where it was so foreign to me. But I had to adjust my way of thinking and my approach so that I wasn't, I guess I wasn't threatening to them. I was somebody who just wanted to fit in and wanted to race cars. At the end of the day, all I wanted to do is race cars, and if it meant my changing, you know, my approach to be successful in doing so, in other words, in being somebody who the team really wanted to pull for and us all being successful together, I was willing to do that. The last thing I want to do is, you know, ram my way of thinking and culture down their throats, and the next thing you know, they're leaving a lug nut loose on the wheel, or they're leaving, you know, something off the car, and I go careening into a concrete wall or a safer barrier or whatever at 180, 190 miles an hour. That does not achieve the goal. I want to be successful. I want to win. I want to do the best that I possibly can. And to be able to do that, you have to be a team. And for a team to be all pulling the same direction, everybody has to really want to get it and get there together. And so that just meant, you know, just really infiltrating myself to just be one of the guys here at NASCAR.
One of the things that I think is your strength, but also the reality of realizing that you could, and you said this in a quote, there was no way that I could affect change during the time that I was racing. This is a different day. And I thought that wisdom of saying, look, you looked at it. If you could have, you would have, but you can't. So you're not going to beat your head against a wall because you know you're not knocking it down. Was that a realization you came to, or how long did it take you to come to that realization?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I realized that coming here, I was a very small fish in a huge pond, and the timing just wasn't right, like you mentioned. There was nothing that I could really do to really affect change. I made my voice heard when I could, when media personnel would ask me, you know, well, Bill, how does the Confederate flag make you feel and all that kind of stuff? And I would tell them point blank, it makes me uncomfortable. I've said it before, you know, and I still say it. And, you know, I just say that, you know, as long as nobody was waving a flag right in front of my face, I was okay. I looked at it as this was their culture, and this is something they grew up with. And NASCAR was definitely not, in the mid-2000s, ready to listen to a different point of view. This is what the sport was built upon and what have you, with moonshiners and all that kind of stuff, getting away from the law and then putting their, you know, vehicles on racetrack, et cetera, and so on. And, you know, it wasn't the time in the mid-2000s. Now, unfortunately, with the death of, you know, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and the Black Lives Matter movement, now ears are open and people are listening. And the difference between now and before is that it's not just black folks having grown tired, completely tired of being tired of what's going on with systemic racism and, you know, racial inequality and police brutality. They see it just as well as we see it. And so they even say, that's ridiculous. Enough is enough. We must do better as a country. And so this is the time. I am so glad that Bubba Wallace is at the level on the platform that he can affect change. And that's what he proposed, and NASCAR was receptive. They listened. They banned the Confederate flag. They before one of the races, they talked about that being Steve Phelps specifically, the president of NASCAR, talked about that NASCAR stands for equality. I was floored. I was blown away by the fact that they made that stand, because I would have never thought when I was racing that this day would come. I was so moved by it that I actually reached out to Steve Phelps after the statement was made about racial equality and NASCAR standing for that, and sent him an email commending the position that NASCAR took. And within a few hours, he got back to me telling me that he appreciated my recognition of it and that we needed to catch up with each other, at which point we did subsequently a couple of days later. And then he told me about some other things that NASCAR had as initiatives that they were going to be bringing forward. He couldn't disclose them with me because they hadn't been formally announced, but he alluded to some things. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, the Confederate flag was banned, and a significant appointment was made in that Brandon Thompson was brought in to be the vice president of diversity and inclusion, an internal promotion. He had been with NASCAR for 17 or so years, and they brought him into this position whereby he is hopefully successful in establishing and carrying through initiatives, more initiatives to affect change.
We only have a minute left, but when I think about the change, of all of the sports organizations, I would have never thought NASCAR would be out in front on something this important. But when you look back on your life and your career in racing, is there that one moment, Bill, that is kind of engraved in your mind in about 45 seconds?
Absolutely. I would say the single proudest moment of my racing life was when I qualified for the Golden Corral 500 at Atlanta Motor Speedway in 2006. I mean, everything was stacked up against me. I'm a 45-year-old rookie in the Cup Series. I'm in Bill Davis Racing Equipment, which didn't have any factory alliance and probably was not supposed to do very well. But I wound up qualifying 19th out of a field of 52 or 53 cars in my first race, out qualifying guys like, you know, Tony Stewart and, you know, just people that have been Cup champions. And here I am in my, you know, debut race. And I did it with doubters and naysayers. If you even heard the broadcast of the qualifying, Darrell Waltrip and Larry McReynolds even doubted that I was going to qualify. And when they saw the times I posted, they did an about face so fast, I'll have your head spin. So I might have had a lot of people that didn't think I could do it, but I always believed in myself.
Bill, I want to thank you very much for sharing your life and your story in auto racing. It's very inspirational. You are welcome here anytime, my friend. Take care.
Thank you very much, Ron. I appreciate being with you.
Again, Bill Lester, one of only seven black drivers to race in NASCAR's top-tier Cup Series and was the first African-American to win a Rolex Sports Car Series race. We continue on Sports Byline.